I was 155 pounds when I was drafted, so I was this tiny little catcher. And when I went out to the minor leagues, everybody's like, this is our third pick? Like, this is a joke.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. On today's episode, I'm talking to 14-year big league catcher Mike Lieberthal. The third overall pick of the 1990 draft, Mike had a behind-the-plate look at over a decade of change in the big leagues. We talk sitting behind not one, but two star catchers during his early time in the show, finding a way to tap into more power during the middle of his career, and what keeps you coming to the ballpark every day when you're on the backside of your time in the big leagues on a ball club in the middle of a long postseason drought, as Mike's Phillies were the victim of sharing a division with the 90s Braves, and he gives some insight on facing John Smoltz, Glavine, and Maddox. We also talk the landmark moments he saw firsthand, from being called up during the strike season of 94 to seeing steroids gain prevalence in baseball and his experience of the legendary 1999 All-Star Game. Really enjoyed Mike taking the time, and I think it's something about catchers, but they've just always got a great insight on baseball, so I hope everyone enjoys the episode. If you enjoy this one, remember episodes from Phenom to the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. If you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure to subscribe to Baseball America. America.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. We're heading into college baseball postseason and covering all the goings on early in the minor league baseball season. Prospect Hot Sheet Pod. Always a good time to be subscribed to Baseball America. And with that, let's talk to Mike Lieberthal. All right, joining in for today's episode from Phenom to the Farm, he was the third overall pick in the 1990 draft by the Phillies, longtime big league catcher Mike Lieberthal. Mike, thank you so much for joining the show.
Yeah, anytime, pal. Thanks for having me, man.
Of course. And before we get into it, you've now joined the podcast game. So walk me through Believe Phillies.
Yeah, BLEAV.com. And I guess, I didn't know anything about this podcast. They've been doing football and college football or basketball, and they just started baseball this year, the first year. So I did a podcast for James Burnett, and he's just a local kid. He's 25 years old, I think. Yeah, I think he's still taking college classes. And he asked me, I did like a little podcast for him like a while ago. So he's like, Mike, you know, Believe.com is getting into baseball and they want like a representative from every team and I can be your host. And, you know, he pitched it to them and they were like, great, perfect. So after every series, we do like a little, it's not that long, it's like 15 minutes. Just a little update on what I saw during the series and just all about the Phillies, really. So it's twice a week. And, you know, you got to watch a lot of games. And baseball is so many games. So I find myself every day. I mean, you have the MLB channel, so you can record it. So commercials, I've actually timed it. I can get through a game in an hour and 15 minutes.
So well, and now the action's cut down. You can get through a game faster.
Yeah, but I got to watch pitch to pitch. So I got to like fast forward from each pitch. You know, I'm really kind of like scouting it out. So, I mean, obviously you can do the highlights in like 10 minutes, but, you know, I enjoy it. I enjoy watching games, and it's just one team. It's not like I have to cover like every team. That would be really hard. But it's fun, and it's pretty easy. And James is a great host.
And as we'll get into when talking your career, it's the team that you are intimately familiar with. The long time tenured player is kind of becoming a day of the past in some form or fashion. But People really know you as a Philly, but let's get into before that. When did you realize as an amateur that you were going to have a future in pro baseball?
When I made the varsity team as a freshman, but I was a second baseman. I always caught. My dad always had me catch on different teams here and there. So, but I was an infielder until my senior year in high school, and then I just figured out that I just couldn't run as fast to be a high round pick. So my dad had me doing track lessons. I couldn't get that 60 time down below 7. So I think 7.0 was my best. And he's like, no one's going to draft you as 7.0 shortstop. You have to move to third base or catching. And catching was like my best position. And I had the arm strength for it. So that was the transition in my senior year in high school. So I would probably say like probably my sophomore, junior year, I was like really focused on baseball, playing on probably 5 different teams and playing with older players. So that was my career path.
And as you get into that senior year of high school, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, kind of a different time in terms of no perfect game, no online databases, all these things as far as tracking. Since you grew up the son of a scout and, you know, scout in-house, what were the conversations between you and your dad having a realistic view of what your talent is, where you should go, and what kind of, you know, what kind of pro you would make. Because any kid getting attention from colleges, attention from the draft, you probably have these, you know, any kid saying you're going to be a first round pick, you probably have these high dreams of this is what I am, but you have some direct influence in the house of who can tell you, okay, son, this is what I think you are.
Yeah, I kind of grew up with a Tiger Woods dad. He was not the nicest dad in the world. So, and he put a batting cage in, I think, when I was 9 years old, when he figured out I only got one hit in pinno pitch baseball. And the coach on the team was like, your kid is so good at catching the ball in his arm. I've never seen anything like it. So my dad's like, oh, God, we got to put a cage in the backyard. My mom would feed balls in the machine, and he would just sit there on the side and yell at me the whole time. And so for 3-4 hours every game, every day, and really after school, it was just like, you know, it was something that I was good at, and it was something that I took advantage of, and I worked hard at it. So throughout my career, and then once you get into high school, it was like all there was Baseball America. It was like, you know, I think Peter Gammons was doing like the top whatever college high school prospects. And so that's all you would look at. Like, oh, I think I'm going to go 11th in the draft. Like by the time my senior year, I didn't know I was going to go third pick. I knew I would go in the first round probably, but you didn't know what pick. And then the Phillies called and they're like, will you accept $225,000 what the guy got last year? My dad was like, done deal. Take them. So it's pretty a little different back then.
With that though, I will, you know, it's an obvious thing. It's easy to be good at something. Like, it's easy to enjoy something when you're good at it, but especially the position that you're going to play in the minor leagues and just in general and the work that goes into all that, it, for most guys to succeed, it needs to be something of a labor of love. Did you have a love for baseball, you know, upon getting drafted in high school?
I did. I was an only child, so I would always have to play, you know, against myself with this like rubber ball against the garage and play these games. We had these like cobblestone driveways, so bounces were going everywhere. So I think that's like how I kind of developed into at least a good infielder throughout, you know, when I was little. And there was a lot of, you know, lonely days, but I totally enjoyed it. Like, that's what I did, and that's what I practiced. And I mean, I played Pop Warner football too. I loved that too until high school. I remember my dad saying, hey, once I got into high school, do you still want to play football? And I'm like, Dad, these guys are pretty big. I don't think I have a position in football. So that's when I really stuck to one sport and focused on that. But yeah, it's just, I mean, it's a long process and you just got to keep getting better every year. I was 155 pounds when I was drafted. So I was this tiny little catcher. And when I went out to the minor leagues, everybody's like, this is our third pick. Like, this is a joke. Like, are you kidding me? We could have had Alex Fernandez. We could have had these college guys that are ready for the big leagues. And he's 150. How is he going to make it through the season? I mean, they still tell high school players now, like, oh, you got to put on weight. You got to start lifting. You got to, I mean, I didn't lift weights until I was really in the big leagues. Like, I mean, they didn't have any weight rooms. Now they have weight rooms everywhere in every minor league city and nutritionists. And, you know, we didn't have that. We ate pizza and peanut butter and jelly and really didn't see a weight room until the major league. So I didn't really put on weight until I think it was like 24, I would say. So, and everybody thought that I wouldn't make it through, you know, East Coast minor league season. You're still playing 100 and whatever it is, 40 games and hot, humid, and I'm 155 pounds coming out, but I made it. So it was just, you know, for those young, skinny catchers out there in high school, you know, it's okay. Don't hurt your arm. Don't hurt your golden, you know, baby trying to do, you know, an extra bench press.
So with that, though, I mean, catching 100-plus games in the minor leagues is in riding in buses in between series and stuff, like we've had catchers on the show before, and they all talk about one of the biggest adjustments to minor league baseball is not just the opposing talent, but the physicality of playing that position. And especially in, you got drafted in days before kids were playing 200 games a year or whatever kids are playing now. So was there a big hurdle, or were you kind of just naturally fit enough or ready enough, you know, physically to handle that as you got into minor league baseball?
It definitely is a small hurdle because you are playing in the middle of the summer. It's hot, it's humid, California, it's dry. It's not near the heat index. So it's and you're playing with wood bats, you know, the aluminum's gone. It's tougher to hit. It's, It's a grind. You wind up going to a lighter bat, maybe the last 2 months of the season. I mean, I didn't hit well my first year coming out in rookie ball. I think I hit 228 with only four home runs, and I had to literally develop into like kind of a singles hitter to learn how to hit, to shorten my swing, let you know, the next few years in the minor leagues. So, and then my power really didn't come back until maybe my, second year in the major leagues, not till 97. So I was, it took a while to learn to hit, to learn, in the minor leagues, play every day, learn the wood bats. Everybody's a lot better. I mean, you're coming out of high school, it's tough. It's a little different when you're 3 years older, maybe coming out of a junior in college, you're a lot more developed. So I think it's, it is tough for a high school kid coming out.
When you were in the minor leagues, you advanced to double A for your age 20 season after just 16 games below the level. That's a little more common now. The guys are getting pushed a little more aggressively. That's really aggressive for the 90s. Is that when you jump into that age, the average league age is well north of 20, like mid 20s. What was that adjustment for you like, and did you feel ready for that level? Because again, as the son of a scout, you probably had something of an idea, a better idea of what the minor leagues were like compared to the normal high school draftee.
Yeah, I mean, I made it to the major leagues in 4 years, and that was due to an injury. Dalton broke his collarbone in 94, and I came up for half the year. In 95, he tore ligaments in his knee, and I came up for half the year. So I did spend four full seasons in the minor leagues, which is short for, a kid out of high school, 18 years old. It's an adjustment. I had to make the adjustment my first year, like I said, with hitting. I had a great, I hit 300 in Spartanburg my second year in single A. So I felt like as a hitter, I was ready for double A. And, I hit well in Reading, was called up, I think, half the season or three quarters of the season up to triple A. So I was in triple A pretty quick. And I think that was the biggest difference from double A to triple A. You have a lot of major league players in triple A, a lot of older players. I remember I was playing against Bernie Williams, Gerald Williams for the Yankees. I remember playing Scranton, and I was like, geez, these guys are really good. That was the biggest jump I thought for myself going from Reading to Scranton.
You mentioned Darren Dalton and like the legacy of Phillies catching, because he took over for All-Stars before him. As you get up to AAA and you start knocking on the door, how much do you start paying attention to, okay, this is what's going on at the big league level, and then, this is who I would have to unseat? Because as a cat, it's not like you weren't a guy where it was like, well, we could move his bat to first base or the corner. It's like you're a catcher. There's one of you playing at a time.
Yeah, the reason I was drafted by the Phillies in the first round is because Dalton was hitting, I think, 202, and I think he hit 196 the previous year. So Dalton was on his way out. And then by the time I was drafted, the next few years, he just started having these career years and becoming the man in Philadelphia. And, it was kind of like at the tail end of his career, 93, they went to the World Series. It was it was tough replacing a guy like Dalton because he was so well respected. He had those all-star years at the end of his career. And, it was unfortunate that, I was called up through a collarbone, broke his collarbone in between innings. I'm trying to block a pitch. And then the next year he tore ligaments in his knee. So he was injured. And then he wound up going to the Marlins only to play first base. The Phillies were ready for myself, and then actually when I came up to the big leagues, they signed Benito Santiago because they weren't sure if I was really ready to play every day. So in 96, Benito was signed. He winds up hitting 30 home runs or 30 some home runs for the Phillies. I was like, oh great, Benito's like in his last couple of years and he hits 30 home runs coming over here to Philadelphia. So but I was ready. I played I think I hit seven home runs as a backup to Benito, and I don't think they were willing to pay him the next year. So and then I finally got my starting opportunity in 97.
Well, walk me through that initial call, though. Did it work as though you hear that Darren Dalton has gone down and you figure you're getting the call, or was everything a complete surprise?
Yeah, I'm in Rochester, New York, and the game just ended. And our manager said, yeah, you have a call on a payphone in the clubhouse, which, come on. And it's Lee Thomas on the other line, his general manager from the Phillies at the time. And I'm like, oh, right then I'm like, oh God, what happened? And he's like, Mike, we need you tomorrow. We're playing the Pirates, but you're not playing. It's a day game, but the next day we're going to LA, play the Dodgers, and Dalton broke his collarbone. So we need you up here right away. And I was like, oh my God, we're going to LA to play the Dodgers. So It was pretty classic. My first game, I had to leave like 60 tickets, and I'm asking all these veteran players, like, Kruk and Dykstra or whatever, can I have your tickets? Are you using your tickets? As this little 22-year-old. So, and the
Because
same thing happened
you
the
were
next
from
year.
California, so
Yeah, from
that meant
California.
that the friends every the whole friends and family had to come to the first game.
Yeah, it was crazy. And then it's so fortunate. The next year, he breaks his or he tears ligaments in his knee, getting picked off, I think, at second base or something. And the next day, they're going to LA. Like, really? 2 years in a row? Like, right when I get called up, we're going to LA. It was pretty cool.
You mentioned you almost took one of my questions. You mentioned Kruk and Dykstra and obviously Darren Dalton. A lot of personalities in that Phillies clubhouse. At age 22, navigate, you get called up and these guys are suddenly your coworkers, but have some of them have 10 years in the big league. Some of them are notorious for one reason or another. Just what is it like being, a college age kid in a clubhouse full of grown men when you're also thrust into the position of field general?
Yeah, it was the coaching staff of Fregosi, Boa, Vukovic. I mean, we had a tough coaching staff too. Those guys were not easy. And with all those veteran players, I mean, I was in spring training for a couple of years with them, just, so I knew who they were before I came up in '94, just being in spring training with them. But yeah, a little different era with like this, cigarette butts. Guys are smoking in the clubhouse. Lenny got him as the character, and I mean, they had characters all throughout the team. Danny Jackson, Mitch Williams, Curt Schilling. It was an awesome team to be around. And I mean, I was just like quiet church mouse, just kind of not saying anything. So,
Who was the toughest guy to be behind the dish for?
oh, wow. Danny Jackson was tough to catch. His ball moved everywhere. I mean, you would call for a cutter, he'd throw a sinker. He was nasty and tough. He would just wear my thumb out. The most demanding pitcher was probably Curt Schilling. He put a lot of time into his starts, and he wanted you as well as the catcher to put as much time, and so he wanted everyone to be on the same page. So he was probably the most demanding. But yeah, Danny, I would always say Danny Jackson was it. Everybody thought like who was the hardest pitcher you caught, but it's all a matter of movement, really. It's not how hard you throw. It's pretty much how wild or, how much movement you have back there.
What did scouting and start prep look like in the mid-90s as far as how much information you guys had?
Yeah, it was mostly, a coach. Usually Vukovic was the guy that kind of ran through each team and all the reports. He had his book all written down. Nothing was on computer. Nothing was on iPads or anything like that. Or the stats were a little different. It was always keep the ball down. Always say down, just keep it down. First ball swinger, kind of basic, what you would think of today, what they go through in hot zones and cold zones. But I felt like it was a little easier back then. But the only hard part was everything was on tapes. So if you had to watch a team before a team came in, you would spend 3 hours just to go through like four or five tapes watching hitters.
When you say Vukovic, it's not Pete Vukovic, is it?
No, John Vukovich.
Okay. I had to ask if it was Clu Hayward.
Right.
But the year you get called up is also the strike season, which we've had one player on this show, Bob Tewksbury, who was kind of winding his career down in the strike season, had already, made his money, gotten his tenure, things like that. What was it like coming up as a rookie where you're probably not as well versed in the labor situation of baseball, or you're not eligible for arbitration, anything like that. Like, just as you're seeing everything kind of come down, and you're like, "Hey, I'm here now. Can we keep playing?" Like, what was that experience in terms of just watching baseball shut down just as you get to the big leagues?
Yeah, I still remember these conferences that we would have with like 25, 30 guys. I'm back at home, just talking about when are we going to get back to work? When, Lenny Dykstra's on the phone yelling at Joe Girardi how much money he's losing. I think he just got his big contract and how he's going to take up tennis and become a professional tennis player. And I just remember them arguing on the phone back and forth. And I'm like, just this, little 22-year-old just kind of like just listening. And, it's just very, it was unfortunate, but it actually worked out in the long run. And it was funny because I think that 94 season we were like in first place when the strike hit. So we were doing well as a team. So it was, God, it was so long time ago, but that's like my best story from 94.
As you mentioned, you know, Darren Dalton moves on. They move on from Benito Santiago. So after a couple seasons, 97, you become the guy. Catch 134 games. What's the biggest difference between catching a full minor league season, catching a full big league season? Like, how much did your life change?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot more pressure. There's cameras, camera one, camera two. My parents can watch at home. My dad can yell at me, tell me what I'm doing wrong. I mean, in the minor leagues, you can't see any of the games, but it was pretty funny. It was different, different pressure playing in Philadelphia. We had a group of players that were kind of rebuilding. And then they hired Terry Francona, and we had all these young players. Scott Rowland was a rookie and coming in. It was just a growing kind of team, especially playing in a division with Atlanta Braves, who I think they won the division 10 years in a row. They had their star four or five starters, and it was there wasn't many wild cards. I don't know if there was a wild card, maybe one wild card. So we weren't making the playoffs. There wasn't very many people at the vet at that time because, you know, they won in 93 and now we don't have a very good team. So imagine the vet. I mean, it holds 65,000 people and there's only like 10,000 people at the vet. So it was a different time playing at the vet. But I mean, I enjoyed playing there. I enjoyed playing on AstroTurf with a lot more hits and the history there. So, I mean, it took a while before we kind of got our feet on the ground.
You mentioned sharing a division with the Braves, which meant that you had to see Maddux, Glavine, Smoltz a million times.
A million, so many times. And we played our division so many times, not like it is now. So Smoltz,
which of those guys he's on the mound and it feels the most defeating?
Yeah, Smoltz completely owned me. If you look at the stats, it's just gross. His slider, I think I swung on every time. He hung one slider in Atlanta and I got him. And that was like a miracle. I think he said whatever he said. Damn it. I think when the ball was like halfway there and I hit a home run. But all the other times, and it was never a strikeout hitter. Like if you look at my stats, I barely really walked. I didn't walk very much and I never struck out very much. And I think Smoltz struck out. If I struck out 32 times a year, I think Smoltz struck me out half those times. So. I mean, I hit Glavine really well.
Kept the ball in play.
Yeah, I hit Glavine really well. I love those lefties, and I always got on top of the plate. And, Maddux, I never really struck out too much off Maddux, but I put the weak ground balls in play off Maddux, so I didn't really hit well off them.
Well, during that same time as you're catching, you're in charge of handling a pitching staff, you know, keeping runs off the board. Guys are getting bigger. Balls are flying out of the yard with more regularity. How, as you saw in your time in baseball, especially from becoming a regular to say 97 through the end of your career, when home runs became more prevalent, more not just the Barrys and the Maguires and the guys that were leaving the yard, you know, 50 to 70 times a year, but just in general, more guys down the lineup with the ability to lift the ball out of the yard. How did that change how you went about, if at all, how you went about calling a game when the home run was just so much more of a threat than more contact guys trying to put the ball in play?
Yeah, I don't think guys were really – I mean, they knew, like, I think Brady Anderson, when they were like, how did Brady Anderson hit 51 home runs or something?
The Brady Anderson like, year is, like, the example that everyone dips to. It's like the
yeah,
Brady
it's
Anderson
like,
years.
What?
When it's like, man, things are getting out of hand.
I mean, everybody knew, like, okay, Canseco, Maguire, you know, these guys are just – they got to be on something. And Sosa, and he's hitting 500. So those were like really the only guys were kind of looking at, like, oh, well, they're on something. And then when they come to the plate and you jam a guy and it breaks his bat and it still is a home run, you're like, how is that fair? Like, you know, like Maguire would come to the plate, I'd be setting up like a foot inside because, you know, I mean, he's right on top of the plate. You can't pitch him away. And the only thing you can do is either hit him or throw it a foot off the plate. And I remember one ball, I think it was a foot off the plate. He stayed inside, it broke his bat, and the ball still went for a home run. And it was like, I give up. That's it. It's over. Can't pitch to him. And then obviously the 99 All-Star game was such – watch him and Sosa just murder balls, and everybody was out there watching, was quite the spectacle. I mean, it was awesome for baseball at that time. nobody was really talking about it as a fan, but I think as players, you knew like, okay, some players are doing something. And then I think it just spiraled. Like then, you know, then you got A-Rod and then like different players and more players are producing a lot more home runs. And it was just kind of spiraled from there. But in the beginning, I thought it was just a few players. I mean, I think Canseco was like the first one. Oh, okay. He's doing something. You know, of course he's been doing it for years probably, or, you know, but then, yeah, it's just that Maguire Sosa thing just took off. And that's when everybody just started, I think more players started using, and then it became a big deal.
Did it bother you? Especially again, you're in charge of trying to make sure these guys don't leave the yard, and you've got dudes with biceps the size of your head stepping into the plate. Like you said, early 2000s, things really start to take off. You know, was it something that you guys like internally complained about of, hey, we got, you know, we got the Giants in town, or we've got the Cardinals in town, and I'm, you know, I'm a catcher, and my pitchers are just trying to get these guys out. Is it something that you guys grumbled about at all?
Not really, because in the 90s, I think maybe in 2000s, it became like a lot of players were using, but I don't, in the 90s, I don't think there was that many players really using steroids at the time. So it was just kind of like, who knows if he is, who knows if he is. Everybody knew, like, you know, of course, Sosa, Maguire, these guys are hitting 550-foot home runs. So it didn't seem like that many players. And then it became like, why is every pitcher throwing 97? What is going on now? Like in today's day, it'd be like 100, you know, it's like 3 miles an hour difference on the gun, out of the hand or crossing home plate. And it was like, how come every reliever that comes in is throwing, let me guess, 97 with a sinker? What's going on here? So it was like Gagne. Remember Gagne would come in and throw 100 with the nasty split. And you're like, how is that possible? I have not seen anybody throw like this before.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money at
Menards. I watched that the showdown he had with Barry Bonds in that All-Star game on YouTube often, and it's truly an incredible feat of human performance and apparently chemical performance. But it's, I mean, those guys. So with that,
Kevin Brown, Kevin Brown's throwing 97 with the ball running like 3 feet, like. How's a guy throw with a sinker throwing that hard?
Well, and on that same subject, like now we, you know, it's kind of thing. Oh, everyone's throwing hard, and there's all the, you know, there's all this, you know, all the conversation about that, and, you know, contributing to injuries, whatever. But I remember fondly when I was growing, like when Joel Zamaya popped up, and it was just like, wow, this guy throws, like, it was such a spectacle when someone throws hard. And what was that like for you guys when, you know, velocity was just down compared to now in the 90s? Like how much of an advantage was that when a team would bring out a guy who was like 95 to 97 plus? Like how much did that stick out for you guys in a series?
Yeah, you didn't see it that often. Remember Mark Wohlers for the Atlanta Braves? He was like that first guy that throws maybe 100. And I think in the 90s, the gun, like I said, was crossing home plate. I guess they would get your speed, not out of the hand. So there's probably 2 to 3 miles an hour difference between now. And it just didn't seem like there was, you know, Billy Wagner, Mark Wohlers. You had like a few guys that would come in that would throw 97 to 100. Like I remember John Smoltz from, you know, when he was starting, he was throwing about 95. And then as soon as he went to the bullpen, he was throwing like 98, 99. And you're like, wow, that was like a big difference just throwing one inning for him. Obviously, he wasn't on any kind of performance enhancers, but just for him to go from starting to relieving. So it just didn't seem like there was, like, today, in today's game, there's, like, it seems like five guys in every team that throw, like, 97 to 100. Like, it's amazing. Like, just the difference in, I don't know what it is, the rehab and the weighted balls. I don't know what they're doing, but it seems like a lot more players playing, a lot more pitchers, better programs, stronger, the guns, 2 to 3 miles an hour difference. So you do see, you know, guys clocked a little higher, but Yeah, like I said, when in the 90s, you really didn't see too many guys throwing that hard.
Yeah, the influx of velocity has just been outrageous, but
Yeah.
which kind of it takes away from the novelty of guy like Zumaya or Aroldis Chapman is still incredible, but like when he came around, he was the only guy like that. Now there's a bunch.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the vet wasn't really filling up, that you guys had gone from, winning a World Series to not so much, and you're throughout your career as a Philly. You guys, dealing with the Braves, tough to break through that ceiling, fewer playoff spots. As you get older and older throughout your career, you're still the guy behind the dish, but you come into every w was there hope every spring training? Is it the hope springs eternal thing, or did you get jaded at a certain point of man, am I not never going to get to the playoffs?
Yeah, it's tough when you're in that division with the Braves for so long, and some players are in that unfortunate situation. I think it was like Robin Yount with the Brewers. You got Mike Trout with the Angels. It just doesn't happen. And you can have superstar players on your team. There's always hope. Scott Rolen, we had Rico Bronya, we had Bobby Abreu. I mean, we had some like really talented players out there. We just really didn't have the pitching. We had Curt Schilling, but we didn't have that many pitchers after him to really help us out. And we're just in that situation. You always have hope. I mean, we had Tito Francona, a new manager. It was just always that hope if we can take down the Braves. Can this be the year? And then obviously breaking into the new stadium, it's like, okay, we have new hope, new stadium, new ballpark. We're going to be a new team. And that was like an exciting part in Philadelphia.
How much did the new ballpark change your life and change your day to day? Is it like moving from an old apartment into a nice new house?
Oh my God, the rats at the vet. Jesus. I mean, that AstroTurf, and I don't know. It was I mean, you're like in this clubhouse that's like so ancient. And just I remember going through from like you had to go from the bullpen to the clubhouse. Like if I had to go down there and I'm not catching it in a game and I have to go warm up a pitcher in the bullpen, you're in spikes on this like marble cement that you have to, get down to the bullpen real quick without falling and then run back if you have to pinch hit. It was just, God, the vet was crazy. And then I mean, got a lot of stories there, but it's just, to go to grass. Actually, I loved hitting on turf. There's a lot more hits, a lot more doubles. The vet had a great hitter's background. It was great. It was really a good place to hit in. And then you're going from a much smaller field, grass, totally different amenities in the clubhouse. From now you have whirlpools and swimming pools in the clubhouse and locker rooms. It was a very exciting time. I mean, we didn't win when it opened in 2004 or 5 or 6, but it was an exciting time of fans. Now you have packed house almost every night. Well, I mean, I think the only packed house we had at the vet was like fireworks night or some special night where, maybe opening day. Opening day and fireworks night were big nights at the vet throughout those losing seasons.
In the same vein of moving from something that's a little older to something new, you mentioned Terry Francona coming in, taking over for Larry Boa. What did you see during those years playing for Terry Francona that you think would explain the success he eventually had with the Red Sox and with Cleveland?
Yeah, he was so personal with his players. I mean, we had obviously a tough time. We were losing a lot, but he was always the same guy every day. He'd always let you know when you're gonna have an off day, when you're gonna play, what the lineups are gonna be like the next day. He was very his communication skills with his players was great. So he's fun to play with. I'm sure most managers are now. They're a little different than they were, I think, back in the 90s and 80s, where managers can get away with saying anything they wanted to a player. I think now it's I think now managers really have to be your best friend to every player on the team. I mean, these players are making so much money and they have so much power now. It's like, you can't be that jerk manager that everyone hates or you're going to be gone.
What was that same vein? What's the meanest thing Larry Boa ever said to you that you can repeat on a podcast?
Oh my God, I can't even get into all the meetings we had after games and why I called this pitch and what what am I doing here? And
so he'd break it down like pitch by pitch, like why did you call this?
And yeah, after a game, leave it all, come in here. He knew I stayed late anyway. I was icing. I was always a late guy staying in the clubhouse. So it was always like, he always wanted to go through the game, which you love that passion. Larry always has that passion. He wants to win so bad. And I mean, I love Larry. And it's just funny if I can tell you so many stories of just after games, you know, just in his office and going through like, why did you call this curveball in the third inning?
Well, for you, whereas we saw in the 90s, guys would rent, you know, the Brady Anderson season, guys would randomly spout out these seasons. Your career looks exactly like a career used to look. You hit your athletic prime of 27, 28, and you turned in your two best seasons as a pro with back-to-back all-star years. What do you think? Was it finally reaching that physical maturity that used to be kind of the ticket, or was it learning how guys pitched you a little differently, or you know what led to just the general improvement for you to level up for a couple seasons?
Yeah, I was just kind of like getting stronger, learning how to hit. At the prime of my career, which they say is what, 27. And it was just funny because I think it was like the next year. 2000 maybe, like I was like at 318. I had a high average, but I only had like 8 home runs, and I was like, how in the do I have 8 home runs, same power as I did the year before? I had 31 home runs, and I'm like, how am I at the end of the year with only 8 home runs? I'm hitting 315, 318, but I mean, it was like, you know, it's one of those things in baseball. Some years you just, I don't know what it is. You have all a bunch of home runs, and the next year you don't, and the next year you do. But I was unfortunate at the tail end of my career. I hurt my knee, and I felt like the last few years it was tough to stay strong in my backside hitting. It was different. I had to make adjustments, and obviously you get older, your bat speed slows down. Your career is very short, so you got to take advantage of that short time. And obviously 27 is your, they say is your, like, you know, your body, the best it's going to be. Your body and mind together is the best it's going to be together. So,
well, that 99 year, you make it to one of the more notable All-Star games of the last 30 years, the Fenway Park game, Ted Williams coming down in the golf cart. I mean, this is a broad question, but what was that experience like just in general of being a part of that All-Star game and that old stadium with the Ted Williams thing, and then the, really the first big time steroid era home run derby that was a true joy.
That was insane. I mean, there was nothing like that Fenway Park All-Star game. I mean, I was in an All-Star game the next year in Atlanta, not even close to what Fenway was with Ted Williams to the mound. I mean, Tony Gwynn, you have all these like superstar older players there, Willie Mays, just like the whole everyone. I was just nervous as hell, and then Pedro Martinez strikes out like 4 or 5 in a row. Piazza starting, but I'm going in like probably in the fifth inning. But it's like the dugout was like, oh yeah, this is gonna be fun, good time. Within like literally 10 minutes, there's like silence, like four or five strikeouts in a row, and it was like, okay, this is okay, welcome to the All-Star game, you know, we're here to win. But it's like, wow, it was intense.
So I was going to ask about that, because that's the, you know, I think Pedro struck out 5 out of 6 that were guys who were either future Hall of Famers or, you know, the best players in baseball who aren't in the Hall of Fame for various reasons. So that was something that affected you guys in the dugout of in an exhibition game that, you know, baseball, the All-Star game is beautiful because guys can still go about 100%. It's not like baseball or football, but even then, Pedro setting the tone actually affected, like rippled through the NL dugout.
Oh yeah, that was insane. What I remember, like everybody's just, you know, loose and talking and just, you know, strike out. Okay, next guy strike out. Jeez, next guy. I mean, Pedro's just pumping, and you're like, wow, game on, boys. Like, all right, here we go. We're here to play. So it was intense. I was definitely nervous when I got in there in the fifth inning. That was for sure.
And you had Jose Lima. You had Lima time.
I know, Lima time. I love Lima time, especially when he played in L.A. He would like leave after a game and just have a big party in the parking lot.
I'm always interested about the pitcher catcher all-star dynamic because it's like, you know, the guy usually gets one inning. He wants to come in and show out for the most part, especially if he's a young guy. You meet a guy at the mound, it's the first time you're catching him. In 2000, you caught two future Hall of Famers. You caught Glavin, who you saw, I'm sure you saw plenty of, and Trevor Hoffman as well. What are those conversations like when you're, you know, getting behind the, do they tell you kind of, hey, I want to throw this or I want to do that? Or, you know,
what's simple. I mean, it might be a little more technicality today's day, but it was basically, we're going one sign on a guy in second. Do not want to cross you up. Nobody's trying to pick signs on second. And I'm going, whatever, 1, 2, 3, 4, fastball, curveball, three, whatever, change. So it was, keep it simple. Not in today's day where you have the monitors on the catcher's shin guards and, you know, and the mics and everybody's earpiece. And I don't even know. They do that in the All-Star game now. They have the mics and the monitors.
They'll do pitch com. I mean, now in the last few years, they've had guys like mic'd up giving interviews while they were pitching.
Right. I know. I love that. Not many guys will really like to do that. They don't.
Would you have done that if that was available in 99, 2000?
For sure. For sure. That would have been great. Like the conversation, especially with the catcher. They should do it more. They did it with Maldonado, I think, in the playoffs. I believe they did that last year, and it was really cool. Mm-hmm. There's just not that many players that want to be mic'd up. You know, and they always tell you, like, whether it's Fox or whatever, don't worry, you can. If you say anything bad, we're not going to use it. Or, you know, like, but it's hard to get players to do it.
There's also a compilation of Liam Hendricks, like, where it's like the most, like, him mic'd up and just him swearing at himself the whole time, which is right. Really fun. So as you get on kind of the back end in your 30s, you know, you've been catching now professionally for over 10 years. Like you said, you start dealing with some injury history. You've been consistently playing on these teams that are not winning. You've made a quality amount of money. Like you've gotten to the point in baseball that guys are trying to get to where, you know, you've at least set yourself up for life after baseball. What is, you know, each season putting the work in, if you know, especially I'm not the guy I was when I was 27. What does your priorities become? What does the work look like? And what is bringing you to the ballpark every day after you've kind of accomplished a lot of the individual things?
Yeah, at that time, it was a lot of rehab exercises between I had back spasms in 2006. I think I was carried off the field, epidural shots. I had my knee problem. I knew I was like relegated to probably backing up in 2007. I had a chance to either play with the Dodgers or Cardinals. La Russa was calling me, so I didn't want to play behind Molina because I knew I wouldn't play at all. And then I wound up playing behind Russell Martin, and he played like every game in 2007. But it was great to come home and play for the Dodgers. I mean, a team that my dad used to have season tickets to, and to come home after every game. So that was fun. But at that time, I knew I had problems even with the Dodgers, like with like these back issues. So it was like going to the ballpark, doing like 2 hours of back exercises just so if I had to get in the game or if I had to play, you know, 2 days in a row, I'd be able to do it. So I knew at that time, just the struggle of being a backup catcher with my injuries. I knew that was my last year. I'm like, all right, this is it, guys. I don't think my body can take me any longer. But it was funny. And then I went to the offseason like for 1 year. My back was like, my back feels great. Maybe I should make a comeback. Anybody give me a workout? I'm ready to get back into it. But it was too late then. So
what was the first year like post baseball? You like you mentioned, you played with the Phillies for 13 years. You play 1 year with the Dodgers, and then they don't pick up your option. And you know, what was that the first, like, especially like the first February catchers reporting and things like that? Like, you know, your life had been as a professional baseball player, you'd spent almost 20 years doing that. What was the adjustment in your day to day, and just kind of the mental adjustment of I'm no longer squatting behind the plate 10,000 times a season.
Right. It was totally insane. It was amazing. I put my golf gloves on, joined a golf course. Actually, I was at the golf course probably 5 years before it, but I was going to be a professional golfer. I was like, I'm going to be a
we all are.
As a 10 handicap. I was like, I'm going to be a professional golfer. No, it was awesome. Just like great for my body. great for my mind, and I love golf a lot. So that was kind of like my next passion. Like, okay, what are you going to do? Like, you can't just sit there and, what are you going to watch TV every day? No, I'm going to go out there and hit 3 hours of golf balls and play with my friends. And then I wound up, actually wound up winning our club championship, got down to like a plus two and was totally into it. A lot of work, a lot of practice, but a lot easier on the knees and back. You get in a cart, you're just like straight to your ball. So that kind of took my passion, from baseball to golf. I still love it today. I don't play quite as much, don't practice quite as much. So it's I'm not quite as good as I was, but that kind of replaced it. That replaced the everyday, you come to, I used to call it the field. Like I would say, like, it's a golf course, but I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go to the field, smell the grass, hit some balls. Like it felt like spring training every day. And that's something that I enjoyed and I still enjoy, but now I have, four kids later. And so it's the kids take a lot of time.
Yeah, I just had my second kid, new baby, and I've golfed once in the last 3 months, and I don't see that changing for a while. But with that, you know, being a West Coast guy, getting to play that last season with the Dodgers, I'd imagine is pretty special. But I'm always curious about guys who do spend an extended time with one franchise. Did Philly become home, or was it just your workplace for 6 months out of the year?
Yeah, I always came home in the off season. I always, for the 3 months, you only have 3 months in the off season to come home, play some golf, see your friends that you grew up with. You have great weather here in California. I didn't want to stay in Philadelphia and be freezing in the snow, and so
Philadelphia,
it
nothing against the city, but doesn't seem like an off-season
made. Yeah, not in the
destination.
winter. Get out in the winter. Go to Florida. Go to California. So it was pretty easy for me to come home every year. I still now, I do fantasy for the Phillies in Florida. I come to alumni weekend and probably come to two or three times to Philadelphia every year. Now it's great. I'm doing this podcast, staying up with the team. I actually went to spring training with the Major League Club for a week. Got to hang out with the coaches and the players. So I got to meet a lot of the players that I really didn't know. And so it's now I'm kind of back in that Philly vibe again. And you never know. It's maybe in the future I might be living in Philadelphia, but for now with all these kids, can't go anywhere.
No, you're nailed to the house.
Yeah.
With that, being in big league camp this year and seeing the difference in what the catching position looks like and the difference in what framing is now, and obviously Philly is one of the best in JT Realmuto. When you watch Philly's games, as someone who grew up in a different era of this is how you're supposed to frame pitches, how does it come across to you when you're watching catchers the best at what they do, but mechanically, in a lot of ways, doing a lot of things differently than catching was in the 90s and the 2000s and even like 10 years ago.
Yeah, as far as framing, I mean, I always frame pitches. You either have soft hands or you don't, right? You either like can frame nice and have soft hands or you don't. Now it's just I got to fool the umpire. So now you can fool the umpire though, and they really bring it up and they want everyone to be on one knee so you can get low and just snag that low pitch at least 4 or 5 times a game and maybe, mess with the umpire, which it does. I mean, if I was umpire, I'd be like, Jesus, I can't tell if that, how you bring it up now and everybody has to be low. I mean, not every catcher is my size. I was kind of small for a catcher, but I had great flexibility and I was able to get low with just being up on two legs. The only reason I don't like, I mean, I like the one knee. I'd be on one knee. That'd be a lot easier. I mean, it'd be easier catching on one knee. I might catch a 40 on one knee. No collisions at the plate too. Geez, that's nice. So, I mean, it's easy on one knee, but the only thing you get on one knee is your mobility, but right and left. I mean, if somebody throws a nasty slider right or left, it's harder to move. You're not like it's like a basketball player. If you're like a basketball player and you get down real low and you have 2 feet up, you're easy to like, the Allen Iverson's gonna go around you on one knee, it'll be a lot harder to kind of move right and left. And sometimes you get these nasty relievers, they're coming in throwing 100, 96 mile an hour sliders, burying it in the dirt. I mean, it's tough to be on one knee, especially on a guy on third. I'm like, how is this guy on one knee just killing? And a guy's on third base and this guy's throwing 96 mile an hour sliders, like I don't understand that. Like I was talking to JT, he actually doesn't like throwing on one knee. He might set up on one knee, and then once he sees him going, he gets up on both legs, or he starts on both legs. So, for the best catcher in the world, he does not like to throw being on one knee. and then getting up to throw from one knee. So he likes being on both knees when he knows there's a fast runner on first base. So that tells you a lot there too. And once the new strike zone comes out, never know, the electronic strike zone, then that low pitch, everybody's like, oh, doesn't matter how you catch it. You know, we got this electronic strike zone, so we'll see with that.
Yeah, we'll see. Especially, I hope they go to the challenge system and not the full electronic system.
I think the challenge system will be next year. I really do think. Like, they've been doing it in the minor leagues where you get three challenges, and they'll probably use it. Most managers will probably use it later in the game, or maybe a big situation, the base is loaded early in the game. That seems more like more sense.
Did you know with certain umps that you were going to be able to steal some more strikes that day than others?
Oh, God. Frank Pulley used to call everything until two strikes. He would tell the hitter, too. He'd call a foot off the plate. What are you doing, Frank? The next pitch, foot off the plate. Oh, I'll tighten it up now. I was tightening up with two strikes. I want to get this game going. It was like classic. We'd be able to set up like literally a foot outside. And, you know, I mean, imagine Glavin and Maddux. I mean, they were getting pitches. Like, you had to get on top of the plate. So, and make them pitch you inside so it didn't look like you were getting, you know, the shaft with these balls being called.
And I've got to ask, and I obviously have a guess of who is the worst person to be behind the plate.
Oh, well, you know, in today's day, who's the worst person? It's, was it Hernandez? Yeah, I mean,
Hernandez. They make famous for being bad.
They make fun of him every time he's behind a player. He's like, how is he calling pitches again? Like, okay, just get him in the outfield. He can't even call foul balls right. And then he's like trying to call pitches. Like, it's funny because these umpires, they never get like, they never retire. And I'm like, do these guys get eye checks? Like, they're like 70 years old. How is he? I mean, what kind of contacts does he have in? You're just like amazing.
Well, you wrap it up after that year with the Dodgers. If you could give yourself a pep talk on draft day, the 18-year-old you, what would that pep talk look like?
Oh, wow. Well, the higher you go, the more money you get. So, especially in today's day, oh, my God. Like, I think I received $225,000 in 1990. And then 91, Brian Taylor for the Yankees is like the number one pick. Chipper Jones was the number one pick my year, $275,000. So, the next year, he set the mark. The Yankees gave him $1 million. I was like, and then from there, it was like,
you
oh,
the
well,
boat.
Then the next
year. Boat by one
I,
year.
No, by 1 year. It's like, yeah, what is $225,000 now? It's like kids are getting that going to college. Colleges are giving them. So it's,
so the pep talk is financial advice?
The pep talk would be probably go to college because, you know, you get your education in 3 years, you're probably going to be drafted. Unless you're in the first round. That was my dad's like, okay, if you go in the first two rounds, you're signing no matter what. I'm like, Dad, what about the third round? I don't know. We'll have to think about that. But
so,
like,
so 18-year-old you would tell, despite playing, you know, playing 14 years in the big leagues, making two all-star teams, you know, making a solid amount of money, you would tell 18-year-old you should probably go to college?
You know what? I would have to see all the numbers now, like from the first round to the third round. Like, what's a third rounder get? You know, like maybe he's getting $400,000. I would say, well, that's not enough money. If you're, where you going to, like, you know, Cal Berkeley, or, you know, it depends where you're going, right? If you're going to school, it makes a big difference too. And now these schools can give players, not only football players, but baseball players, some money too. So,
oh yeah, it's completely changed. I got a quick rapid fire for you, then I'll let you get out of here.
Yeah.
Favorite big league ballpark? I would say visiting ballpark.
Baltimore.
Beautiful, beautiful. Love park. It. Best pitcher you ever caught?
Curt Schilling.
Best pitcher you ever faced?
Kevin Brown, probably when he was on the juice. I don't know. Or John Smoltz. John Smoltz, I would have to say with my numbers.
Scariest pitcher you ever faced, which is a different question than best pitcher you ever faced.
Rob Dibble.
Really?
Yes. I had to face him in spring training. I think I was 22 years old, and I was like, oh my God, this guy's going to drill me. I'm getting hit right in the head. He was so wild, too. Even at the end of his career, he was so wild.
Favorite Philly food spot?
Well, I would have to say Jim's Steaks. I burnt down only because I worked there for like a segment for This Week in Baseball. So I actually, yeah, made some cheesesteaks back there for a few fans and patrons. But yeah, Jim's Steaks. Hopefully it's back up again. So
last question, everyone gets this. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
A nightmare bus story. I wasn't a part of it because I wasn't a rookie, but I remember in San Francisco, you know, from the airport to the hotel. I mean, it was like 11 o'clock at night too, and they said, and all rookies had to dress up in like women, you know, outfits and gear that they we put in their locker. We hid all their clothes, and they had to like wear these like. And we're going to San Francisco, and we drop them off like 2 miles before the hotel. Everybody, all rookies out, and they're all like dressed as women. I'm like, wow, you can't do that in today's day. They would be, it could, yeah, your $25 million player could get mugged.
That'd be a problem. Mike Lieberthal, that's all I've got for you. Thank you so much for joining from Phenom the Farm.
Yeah, thanks, Kyle.
You got it. And that's it for today's episode with Mike Lieberthal. Huge thanks to Mike for stopping by the show, walking us through his career. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. We'll check you back here in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.